Welcome to Scissor Tales Sessions. My name is Jacqueline.
And I'm Aaron.
Thanks for joining us as we share the threads that connect us all, simply being human. This is episode 5, and this week we speak with professional adventure racer Jason Magnus.
Jason lives with his wife Chelsea and two sons in Bend, Oregon, where they operate Bend Racing and jctraining.com.
Jason and his adventure racing team, Bend Racing, were actually featured recently in the World's Toughest Race, which can be found on Amazon Prime. It is definitely worth mentioning that Jason and Aaron are longtime friends going back to their early days of rock climbing.
That's right. We talked some about those early years and how that has influenced his approach to life and adventure racing.
A final note, we are fairly accustomed to it by now, but we spoke with Jason remotely, so there are times you might hear his sons running around in the background or an audio glitch here or there.
So let's get to it. Our discussion with adventure racer and family man, Jason Magnus. You guys grew up in Alaska, right?
Yeah, my dad was in the Air Force, so we were kind of all over the place. But yeah, we went to high school in Alaska and then to Oklahoma, where we met you.
How'd you get to Oklahoma, though?
My brother and I were both, you know, kind of, even in Alaska, we knew that we were into adventure. And we were really good students, like we were really smart, at least grade wise, whatever that means. But so we kind of had our pick, and all we wanted to do is climb. We just learned climbing when we were like 17, mostly mountaineering, and we wanted to go somewhere where there was climbing. And we wanted to go to, you know, California, all these schools, and the University of Oklahoma offered us scholarships, right? Because of they had the national merit thing going on because of the football fiasco or whatever. And so they were basically offering anybody that had a national merit, finalist or whatever, a full ride scholarship plus a stipend.
Oh, right? Wow.
And it was so basically they point blank offered my brother to pay for his entire school and pay him $10,000 over the course, like $2,000 a year on top of that. Right. And then I wasn't a national merit finalist. I was a semi-finalist because I actually had like my first date in high school the night before the test. That's what I blame it on. Maybe I probably just wasn't as smart as my brother, but I had that, and then but literally they wanted the finalists so bad that he called them and said, hey, I have a twin brother too, and I'll only come to school there if my twin brother goes there too. And so they offered me not the same scholarship, but they offered me a scholarship.
So then he used it as leverage, basically.
Yeah, he used his leverage because we knew we wanted to go to school together so that, again, we could keep climbing and exploring. And so we never even visited it. Like, we didn't care, right? Literally all we cared about is that we weren't going to have to spend money on school. And my parents had said that if we got scholarships, we could take our savings, because they, you know, they were good classic 80s or 90s parents where you're like, you have to put so much of your allowance into your college savings. So we had a couple $1,000s, which to 18-year-old is a lot.
Yeah.
So they basically said, if you get a scholarship and go there, you can spend that savings on whatever you want. So we went from like being 18-year-olds with basically no money, you know, and the allowances and odd jobs, to going to school, like having a place to live, right? Food, which was included in the scholarship.
I remember some food stories about
and having several $1,000s. And Oklahoma, at first we're like, dude, Oklahoma sucks. But then, yeah, you know, like then we tapped into the climbers and we started going to Wichita, and then we realized that, you know, school was, you know, I don't know who you're like, I think like we skipped school all the time. Like, I mean, I remember when we were living with Mike Gloob, who's another one of our friends, like we would all sign up for the same calculus 4 class. And like, we would just climb all night in the home gym that we had built. And like one of the three of us would go to class every, like on a rotating schedule, like, cause all we cared about is like barely passing. And I think we all made D's in that class or whatever, or, you know, maybe C minuses, but it was like, you know, and so we'd skip school all the time and go to Texas to climb or Colorado, drive all night. Mm-hmm. It was awesome. Right. So that's how we ended up in Oklahoma, and kind of fell in love with it.
Yeah. Cause you didn't know there was climbing in Oklahoma as you were on your way there, did you?
No, we had no idea. We'd like literally the reason we went to we thought it was okay is because we did the math before you know you had to lay out with the map. There was no instant Google answer, like how far of a driving distance, right? And we're like, okay, well, we can leave on a Friday, like morning, drive all day Friday, and get to Colorado, climb on Saturday, like in the Rocky Mountain National Park, and then drive back on Sunday and make it to class on Monday, right? So that was like, okay, we can do this. And so, you know, for a while we were just driving to Colorado, and then the Wichita's like just opened up, you know, a ton of cool, you know, cool climbing and a lot of good experiences out there. So
you go to college in Oklahoma, you and your brother.
Yeah.
And then you guys are not really attending classes, really are dirtbag climbers who occasionally attend class. What transpires from that situation to where you've decided I'm going to be an adventure racer?
God, there's so much in between there.
Yeah,
it seems like
I want all the in between.
Yeah. So one of the things that, you know, the cool thing is, it's like I've done a lot of these like podcasts and interviews, but like Aaron is the first one I've done with somebody that like knows me for a long time, right? And so, you know, a lot of these formative experiences that made me like who I am, and, you know, especially the adventure person that I am and that I've, you know, created with Chelsea, is like Aaron was a part of, right? Like we were, you know, we were living this dirtbag lifestyle. And, you know, we were still doing decent in school. Like, it's not like we weren't doing school, but we were still doing decent. But like all I was thinking about, I'm sure, was you guys too, like climbing.
We were climbing 4 or 5 days a week, not including the weekends.
Right.
So it was crazy.
And, you know, we had ghetto home gyms and, you know, trips broke, like heartbreak trips to Waco Tanks. That's the one that got written up in the mag. Like, that's a whole nother story, but like, and so these things are happening. And in the background of that is a vacation, I think, whatever summer or winter, where we're at home. This may have been right after, like right after the year we graduated. Maybe, I think we were actually still in college, but there was a show called The Eco Challenge, right? Like, okay. I think we were home at Christmas or something visiting my parents, and it came on, and it was this, you know, adventure race. Like, if you guys saw the current Eco Challenge, it was very, very similar. And so we're watching it, and they keep talking about climbing, and the climbing is just ascending, right? Or repelling.
Yeah, just going up ropes, basically.
That's not climbing, you know? And they're making a big deal about like how dangerous it is, right? In the show, you know, it's Mark Burnett and like the helicopter things, and like, oh, they've got to go up next to the waterfall. And like, this is so, and it's like, what are they talking about, dude? Like, this is insane. Like, this is nothing, you know? And then there's a scene that I vividly remember where these people like mountain biking on this muddy thing, and it's this team, and like they fall down and they can't mountain bike anymore, and the woman gets all frustrated and like she throws her bike and starts crying, and like this, and my brother and I are just watching it. We're like, what is wrong with these people? Like, why, like, like, you know, why are they like, because we had, by this point, we had done a bunch of expeditions. Like, we'd done a trip up Petit Grappin in, you know, in horrible conditions, like bivvying on the side of a mountain, like with no clothes while it's snowing, sharing one frozen power bar, right? And you're just like, this sucks. But like the whole mountain ethic that we built with Aaron and Mike and Adam and all these, and Kevin, you know, in Oklahoma, was like, you got to take care of yourselves. There was no spot tracker. There was no like emergency rescue thing. It was just like, you had to want to suffer. Like, that was really it. Like, you had to want to suffer. You had to go seek it because you knew, you know, it's like the type 3 fun. Like, you're going to get out there and like stuff's going to go wrong. Whether you made the summit or not didn't matter. It really was for us more about those experiences with our friends and with the people, and seeing how tough we were, what we could get through, what we could grow from. And even if I didn't think about it that way in college, that's what was happening, right? And so then we see this on TV and we're like, what? Like, it just was that, I just remember it being the first thing in my head. I was like, someday I'm going to do that, and I'm going to be really good at it, because it's not, you know, they're making it sound like it's the world's hardest race or whatever they do, right? It's TV. That's great. And then I'm thinking to all these experiences I've had with my college buddies, like on purpose, right? And I'm just like, whoa, this feels like totally safe. You're carrying a big radio, and if you get hurt, a helicopter will come get you.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I'm just like, that's pretty awesome. Maybe we can, you know, do crazier stuff.
Yeah.
Right. And it was years, you know, kind of after that when I did my first race, but I just remember thinking of that, you know, with the mountaineering and, you know, even just the fear, like putting up the routes in the Wichitas when we're like just developing unknown things. That was such a cool experience of total self-reliance in the wilderness that I think a lot of adventure racers were coming in from endurance sports, right? I think the way that really got us hooked is that you saw a lot of endurance racers getting into adventure racing because it was pretty lucrative back in those days, but not understanding teamwork, right? And not understanding like true risk assessment, right?
Okay.
And that kind of self-reliance, because in endurance racing, that's never a thing. You're running a marathon or a huge mountain bike race, like there's support, right? And so we came into it, my brother and I, from the other side, where our entire background hadn't been endurance, but it had been, you know, a critical teamwork, technical sport, climbing, right? And absolute self-reliance, right? So we already had those two biggest cornerstones of adventure racing. And then the fitness was really easy to get, right? I think it's much easier to get fitness in any realm than to get like the technical expertise and the mental, you know, or the relationship side of training. Like, you know, we can work on relationships for the rest of our lives and still not be all that good at them.
That's really reassuring in a sense, because I think that there are people that would be interested in doing an adventure race, but they're really kind of intimidated. I mean, I'd say I'm partially intimidated by the level of endurance and the, I mean, going back to the suffering aspect, the pain that's kind of involved or that's expressed through, and maybe that is the media,
yeah,
or through the TV show element. But I like that, you know, highlighting the team aspects and the mental aspects of just being together is so important.
Well, and that's I think what, you know, because I've done a lot of different things, and the thing that has kept me in the sport the longest is that it is so unique in that sense, that it is all about like all about teamwork and self-reliance. The reality is, like, if you want to be at the top level, like, you've got to have a certain level of fitness, right? But you take the guys that won the Eco Challenge, Team New Zealand, like, who've won the world championships for several years in a row, and you put them in an Ironman, they're going to be, you know, top middle of the pack, right? But those guys aren't like, that's not their forte. Their forte is like, you know, their teamwork, their tenacity, their ability to solve problems and to really work together. And yeah, they're all super fit, but, you know, it's a very big difference between, like, you know, an elite triathlete, you know, or having to do that sort of thing. And the greatest thing I think for getting into it is once you realize that, you know, it's fun. Like, if you have that right mindset of adventure, right? Yeah. Like, that's the best thing. Like, I never had that. Like, I did triathlons for a long time before I remembered and found an adventure race to try. Like, when I moved to North Dakota, opened a climbing gym, I was like getting into, you know, triathlons, and it was just not my, like, I kind of forced it because it was all that was up there in the Midwest. But it was just like, you knew the course, you knew the profile. It was very different than anything I, you know, in climbing, you're just like, half the time you can't even find that obscure wall, right?
Right. And the approach is half the battle.
You're already learning that tenacity of like, oh, the approach is going to take 2 hours or five, or we don't even find it. And we discover this different area, you know, and turning that into fun. And that would be my biggest thing, is like, for people that saw the show or now know about it and are like adventure, right? Like, it is, that's what it is, right? Like, yeah, there can be racing, but the racing part is really optional, right? The adventure part is not. Like, in a well-designed course, like, you're gonna feel like you're out there getting lost, like, you know, wading through creeks and bushwhacking and all that kind of stuff, and then as you get better, you can get as competitive as you want, because teams do. But it isn't, you know, and we've had so many people contact us over the last, you know, 10 years to help train them, and everybody wants like a dedicated training program. Like, how many miles should I run? What grade should I run? What kind of, you know, how heavy should my backpack be? How many miles should I do on the bike? And we, you know, the first conversation we have with them is, that's not what it's about. Like, there's like 10 other things you need to do first. And then we can, you know, increase your competitiveness by looking at a little bit of specific training. But really, if you can run, if you can, you know, or even trek, like, you know, hike, mountain bike, and, you know, and can survive a canoe or, you know, a kayak, then it's an amazing sport. And a lot of times it's not the elite athletes that win these things or even do well, right? Which is pretty cool. It's just the ones that race the smartest, that have the best teamwork and have the best relationships out there.
Yeah. I guess definitely it would be good if we could tell our listeners the TV show you referenced, yeah. Since they probably don't know that we know what you're talking about.
Right. It's the reboot, I guess, of that first show that I talked about seeing that kind of engaged me in this. It's called Eco Challenge. And the latest one was produced by Amazon and Mark Burnett. It's Eco Challenge Fiji. And they tagged it the world's toughest race because, you know, certainly in the realm of like competitive events with a start and a finish and a prize purse and all that kind of stuff, like it's pretty out there. And it was 11 days long in Fiji. And the race actually took place in September 19. But they just aired a 10 episode series that's streaming on Amazon right now. And it's, you know, like it definitely does a good, it's been nice for us because we've been doing this sport forever. And I got into it kind of just at what they call the golden age, when there was tons of money in it and sponsorship. And then it kind of like, you know, I was just a low end racer for a long time. By the time I got good enough to like get sponsorship, a lot of the money was gone. And so now it's been kind of infused back in, with, I think it was $100 million production or something crazy like that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
For the Fiji one was $100 million production.
The what?
The Fiji one was a 100 million.
Yeah. Production. I mean, I don't know the exact numbers, but that's the number that was thrown around. I mean, they gave, you know, to make it a level playing field, which I think was really cool. They gave every team that went there, $50,000.
As a prize purse
just to go
basically
to cover costs, like, because otherwise it some of them are hard to make global competitions because you have teams from South America that have a different financial structure, you know, and ability than, you know, somebody say in America or you know, Western Europe that has sponsorship and finances, you know, like Sweden actually has a military team that's paid for by the military, like these guys in the Swedish Armed Forces that can sign up for this are super badass athletes. And if they get accepted, they get 80% of base salary for however long they're on the team and all their gear provided. I'm just like, wow.
That sounds nice.
Yeah.
Can you imagine like that in the climbing world? We're like,
God, no.
Like,
I can't
you're
imagine
gonna be a
it.
Rock climber and we're just gonna pay for all your road trips.
Oh, I can't imagine that.
So they just basically made it so that everybody at least had enough money to fly to Fiji to get the equipment they needed and to you know, make it so that taking 2 weeks off of work was okay.
So in the show, I vividly remember the dad with the two daughter team.
Yes.
And the takeaway I had from that was the daughters had never done anything like this, much less ride the bicycle.
Right.
And there she was attempting to mountain bike through swamp mud.
Right.
And I was just like, well, if these people can do this, then, I mean, Josh and I should be signing up yesterday.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, the cool thing with Amazon versus, like, most races out there is, like, they wanted to show, you know, like, they were very cognizant of turning, of, especially this one. Like, if you watch some of the old ones, which are available, they were definitely not always choosing the positive stories. Like, that's what I remember, is seeing these people, like, yelling at each other and, like, breaking down. I'm like, dude, what, like, why haven't they figured that out before they do this toughest race thing, right? And this one was nice because even when teams were dropping out, like Amazon really did a good job, you know, the producers did, of like, especially in COVID times when they knew they were releasing it, of like most of the stories were positive, right? Like even when teams decide to drop out. And at the same time, I watch it and I'm just like, why? Like, why? I don't understand. Like, this is partly what I, you know, I love about my background that got me into this. I don't understand how somebody can put that much effort into something, right? Like, go so far and train and like build this team and all that stuff, and then drop out because they're feeling uncomfortable. Like, I just, it does not like I it doesn't compute. That's and I'm trying to be like sensitive to that, but I just don't understand it. Like how you're in the middle, like the way that we talk about it is like we talk about the pain cave. Like Dan in the show is in the pain cave. Like he went from being on top of the world, like the best paddler in the world, to like being so deep in the pain cave.
And like on day one, right?
On day one, yeah. We went from first place to 58th place in like the first 16 hours of the race. It was insane. And, you know, and but you're so deep in this pain cave. And the interesting thing in our minds, and we've talked about this in our team, like when you get there, like obviously if there's a medical emergency, a broken leg, you know, like whatever, heart attack, or like that's the nice thing is they have that support there. But so deep in this low point that the only way to get back there, like it's like when you're going exploring in a cave, like if you want to see what's next, like you have to have gone all the way into that cave to see what's a little bit deeper and to see what it's like a little bit deeper. Can you go a little bit deeper? And as soon as you come out of there, the only way to ever get back there to kind of grow as a human into the depths of what you are and what's possible is to go all the way back there, right? And nobody wants to go all the way back there because that sucks. But like Dan's there and we're just like, dude, this is kind of awesome. Like you've never been this low before. Is it possible for us to hang out here and to keep going? Right. You know, we slept and like we're dragging them on the paddle boards. And like, that was the hard thing. Like, well, I know those two girls and their dad's done a bunch of stuff. He's coming to do our, big, you know, we were putting on America's Toughest Race, the Expedition Oregon. They're coming to do that. But like they're there and I'm just like, why not sleep? Like, you know, why not sleep a little extra? Or why not start? You know, one of the things is that I learned in climbing is you try. And then if something forces your hand, like you can't actually go on, then that's a different story. Like if you, in event racing, if you hit a cutoff and the race staff says you were too slow, you're done. Right. Mm-hmm. Then it's a different emotional, response. And it's really a different wiring in your brain. Right. Like when we talked to, like, we talked to neuroscientists about it and we've done a lot of cool research and been part of studies. And the cool thing is that we got lucky in the way that we grew up doing this is like, we created these patterns in our brain, like with Aaron and my brother and Mike and on all these crazy expeditions, that our default answer was we have to make it through. Like that's the way our brain got wired early on. Right. And so if you get into these races, and this is what we try to tell athletes that are just getting into it, like no matter what happens, your first five races, do not drop out. Mm. Right. Let them evacuate you from the course. Right. Let somebody come and say you're too slow. We're going to take you back to the start line. But if you make the decision when things get uncomfortable, right, to stop and to seek comfort, because as soon as you stop racing, your blisters go, like they stop hurting as much. Your knees stop hurting as much. You're like all that stuff. It goes away like that. But as soon as you opt out, you know, to that familiar place, right, then that's the wiring that you're building up in your brain, right? Because it's like we all know what it's like when we're hurting and we're uncomfortable and we're in pain. We all have the experience of knowing what it's like to end that. And I think this goes in relationships. Like this is the breakup thing. Like I had a lot of breakups. It's like, this is like, but what's it like to sit in there and actually do the work? Right. Mm-hmm. To go a little bit further, a little bit longer. And we have a pretty unique thing because and like we don't like most races that we do, like we want to drop out. Like Chelsea, my wife is super tough, but every big race she does within the first 36 hours, she wants to drop out. Mm. She hates it. She just gets to this low point. She's just like, this is dumb. Right. I'm a mom. What am I doing? Right. She just wants to drop out. And we have a rule on our team that because we all want to stay friends, like anybody on the team can want to drop out and can force the team to drop out. Cause in this sport, if one person drops out, the whole team's done. Right. There is no like continuing on. So we can all drop out and the team can't, we're not going to be mad. It's like no questions asked. Right. But the rule is that once you decide that you want to drop out, the timer starts for 24 hours. Right. So you have to want to drop out for 24 hours. And if at any point during that 24 hours, it's 3 a.m, you're dog tired, you're still hiking. And all of a sudden you get to the top of a ridge and the moon comes out through the clouds and you look and say, oh my God, this is so beautiful. Time starts over. Right. So it's this reality that as humans, like things always change. And mm-hmm. and when you've set this huge goal of, you know, for a year of going and doing this event or a climb that you've planned for forever, right? Mm-hmm. That you have to teach yourself to not bail at the first sign or, you know, or the 10th sign of difficulty, right? And I think that's what, you know, when I read all these amazing expedition stories, right? Like I just finished reading Shackleton and I'm just
that came to mind immediately when you mentioned that.
Dude, like those guys just did not give up, right? And eventually it became like, we have to survive. But like they were still, like, look at how far they were still actually pursuing their goal. Like 100 things went wrong and they're still like, well, maybe we can still make it. And you're just like, as a reader, like, dude, you're not going to make it. I know what happened.
Yeah. But
they're still like, they're still there. And then, I mean, it was just remarkable to see that, you know, that the difference in that mindset is, and some of the racers that we've trained that have this habit of going into a race, going really hard, and then not doing that well and dropping out at some point, and then coming back and saying, well, we just need to train harder. I'm just like, no, you just need to not give up. Like, who cares if you win? Like, we've done plenty of races where we're like the last team to finish, right? But, you know, it, because you hear in the Eco Challenge and you hear like the Patagonia Expedition Race is another big one where we go to it, and as a team, we pretty much know, even though it's got a finishing rate of 20%, like the Patagonia race, like, you know, they'll take 20 teams and usually 3 or 4 finish. And the very first time we went, in 2010, we weren't even that experienced as a adventure racing team, but we went and we knew 100% that we were going to finish the race. We didn't know how, we didn't know where, like, but we just knew that us, like, they were either going to pull us from the course, but we were never going to drop out. Mm-hmm. Like, that was just the team that we had. And this was Daniel, who I've done tons of climbing with, and, you know, and all climbing buddies, like our whole team, like our shared thing is that we've all done a lot of expedition climbing. And maybe that's not the magic bullet, but for us, like, you know, being out there and, you know, knowing, cause I think climbing is a great, you know, it's that great thing of it is building in the teamwork. And you joke about not, like, endurance is part of climbing. I mean, carrying a heavy pack.
Yeah.
Right. Like, it just,
well, we just don't think about it a lot of times, but it's like the adventure is getting there. And even the traveling in a car, I mean, you've spent hours and miles just traveling in a car with another person. Anyone who's spent that much time in a vehicle with somebody else, that is part of the challenge is getting along. And not, I mean, I remember certain stories. There was, we don't want to go too far in depth because there's so many stories, but I remember in particular, a friend of ours, Sam, got mad, so mad at either you or your brother, because he was making the oatmeal wrong. And there was almost like an all out fist fight because he was so irritated with how the oatmeal was being made. And it's just those little nagging type of things.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and you know, it's been cool to see that, that camaraderie and some of the, you know, the thing that I think also is amazing about climbing and probably, you know, I've had some conversation with vets, like war vets, and that are similar, I think similar psychologically to war too, is that whenever you get in these really intense situations with somebody, right, and make it through, and thankfully climbing is much safer than war and much less drastic, but like when you're up on a wall with somebody and, you know, and there's rockfall and potential danger, like that's a crucible that builds a bond, I think, that is, you know, and deeper can last a lot of fights, a lot of, you know, a lot of disagreements and all that kind of stuff. And taking that into, you know, the rest of your life is pretty good. And I mean, it's cool because like I haven't seen you for, you know, for years, but it's like I have more in common and connection with you because of those moments that we shared, you know, developing routes on walls, like getting in overhead, like that's, you know, that's something that just, I think it kind of gets written in your, you know, this sounds like Hokkien yoga, but like written in your cellular DNA, like those connections with that person. And so we went into this sport of adventure racing with a lot of that, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's great.
I just find it really interesting that you touched on the military aspect and or the experiences that someone who is a war veteran would have.
Right.
And so I was intrigued by that because my husband, who does the audio, did 15 years in the Army and flew Chinooks and did many tours overseas. And then when he got back, we met rock climbing at Rocktown.
Uh-huh.
And immediately, our first dates were rock climbing.
Yeah.
And so just he was able to bring that knowledge to our then climbing partnership, which became... We got married quickly after, but we have those foundational elements, which I think help, make it work.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just, I just thought that was really interesting that you talked about that.
Well, and I think that's, I don't know how there's a way to kind of build that into our society or our structure, but like having, the vets that I know that have been over there, they have people that they served with that they will not talk to for 20 years. But when their life falls apart and they need something, if there's nobody else to call, like they could call that person and say, hey, I need something. I need help. Right. And
mm-hmm.
that's a powerful thing. And it's a powerful safety net to have. It doesn't have anything to do with your family, the relationships you've built, on purpose with like loved ones and partners. Like it's just something that has been, and it's like, the guy, Sam, Sam that you're talking to, Sam Price that we went to, school with, like, I haven't talked to him in forever. Right. But I can guarantee you that I could call him up. Right. And say like something bad happened in my family, blah, blah, blah. And like, he would do whatever he needed to. Right.
Right. No
like,
doubt.
I literally haven't talked to him in 15, maybe 20 years,
yeah,
who knows,
yeah.
Right? And there's just a lot of people like that I have, that I obviously I wouldn't even think of until, maybe it was that dire straits, but those people that have seen me like absolutely at my worst, my most scared, right? My most vulnerable and like actually the most dangerous, and this is where,
mm-hmm.
Where war gets you to, unfortunately, is like, there are people there and you're actually depending on somebody. I think we take it for granted in climbing because we're so used to it. But like every time you go out, like you're giving somebody else the rope, right? And saying, yeah, like the only thing that's going to keep me alive if I fall is you, right? And so you're trusting them not to have a daydream, like, because we know people that have had that. We know people that have been dropped, right? Have had those bad experiences. Like it was definitely with Aaron. Like I remember being in a situation where there were a lot of people like smoking from the bongs at the bottom of, I don't even remember where it was, but there were people like smoking weed and climbing, which is fine. Like a lot of people do that, but like we were on something and somebody, not Aaron, was belaying that was high, and like, it was either my brother or I, like we have shared memories now, but like got dropped and he eventually got caught, but he fell a long way, right? Yeah. And it was just like not somebody that you were used to trusting, and it was a bad choice in the moment, and we got lucky, and it just kind of makes you think that, Aaron has literally, like, this guy that I'm talking to right now has saved my life countless times, and we don't even think of it like that in climbing, right? Like it becomes this pretty cool, but it's one of the only sports where that actually happens, right? And so now we get in these situations with our other partners, Dan and, and Chelsea, and that we've raced with and climbed with, and we'll be in a situation that is really quite dangerous, right? I remember crossing, like we did this Patagonia race where we decided to take this route up and over these unknown mountains because we knew it would be shorter. We were all mountaineers, climbers, and we're going, and we don't even know if it's gonna go. Like we're looking at a 1 of 50,000 map and we're like, 5-6 climbing and on snow covered ledges with, it's just super sketchy, but we've been doing this a long time, and we're cutting across this slope and we have film of it, which is awesome. It's a steep slope that goes 1,000 feet down to a glacier. Like if one of us blow, and we're kicking steps sideways across it, if one of us blows our steps and goes, we're not roped up because there's no way, it's too steep to stop a glissade on, and we're, it's getting steeper and we're wrapping around hoping it gets to a saddle, and Dan, our big guy, is leading, kicking like these super bomber steps. And we have tennis shoes on because we're adventure racing. We have rocks instead of ice axes. Like we got the sharpest rocks we cut. We're just like going slowly across. And like Chelsea's freaking out, right? She's like, huh, you know, she's like getting kind of hyperventilating and like and whimpering, right? And so like every step, she just got this little whimper going on. And we're just like, dude. And Dan, who's leading the pack, he just turns around very calmly and says, Chelsea, I need you to stop whimpering. She's like, what? You're scared? And Dan's like, totally steely-eyed. He's like, I'm freaking out and you're not helping. We're gonna get through this, right? And he just like, and she just like totally shuts up and like, I trust you, right? And he's like, I'm kicking the best steps I've ever kicked in my life, right? Like his toes were bleeding by the end of it because he's in these super soft tennis shoes, right? And we just go, right? And we're super meticulous. And moments like we had so many moments like that where it really is just, you know, because we do that when we're climbing. Like we have all the skill, like we have all the knowledge, but ultimately we're tr like the biggest part of climbing is that trust you have in your partners, right? That's what makes it possible. Like, because we're all going to fall at some point, right? Aaron didn't fall very much, but he
Oh,
still fell at
no,
some
not
point.
true. I fell all the time.
Yeah, no, you
But
didn't.
that's, you know, I mean, we were both coaches of the climbing team
Yeah.
for over a decade. And I mean, part of what brought me to doing the climbing gym thing, doing the climbing team, is bringing other people into climbing to share with them what I was so passionate about because it meant so much to me and I got so much value out of it. And so I always thought it was cool that you could have these failures in climbing and get back on the wall, like, and try again, and try again, and try again. And I feel like from our perspective as coaches, we really emphasize that as like those moments where you felt like you were failing, you weren't really failing. You just needed to give it another try. Like you just needed to try again. Like you're gonna have to figure out how to, you know, get over the idea that you didn't get the move that you wanted to get, or you didn't get the place that you wanted to get in the competition. But as long as you got back up and you kept trying, then you really haven't thrown in the towel yet.
It's the that idea of redefining success, right? Like society or a lot of us like to define success as like we flashed the route or you know we won the race or we got on the podium or whatever it is, right? And a lot of training and competing and you know going to the mountains is like redefining that, like being able to redefine that lifetime. Like dang, you know I didn't get that flash, but like I'm gonna try again, right? And I'm gonna work it a little differently. I'm not gonna get, you know, or let my frustration fuel me in a good way, right? And I think that's where the, you know, having those experiences as a, you know, like for you guys coaching, I think it's amazing. If you can keep, like, we've got a really good climbing team here and it's nice. And there are some coaches that we think are amazing. And there's some that are, I think, a little too emphasized on like winning or you know,
Yeah,
getting
yeah,
yeah,
oh
yeah,
yeah.
you see that all the time.
We've
Not the,
experienced that.
not, yeah, and not the process, right? Not like
Right,
that's like
right.
we're all going to get. You know, like I'm 45, I have one artificial hip. Like next month I go in to get another artificial hip.
Are you
I
really?
still am
Wow.
trying to race and be as competitive as I can, be a dad. It's like so all these, you know, and crazy, like I just put up my first 5'12" like during coronavirus. Like I don't know, I've climbed
Oh,
like
that's
one
cool.
5'12" my life with Aaron, you know, mostly it was and then like we just found this new area and I'm like just putting up 11 pluses and 12s. Like I'm like, what's going on? Like I just had time, right? Couldn't do anything else and but it's like it was just it's just fun to recognize that we're all like I know it now like I'm sure when I was 20 I was just like a lot of the kids like all that mattered is the numbers and success but really it's having that idea that you're setting a pattern to be happy long when you can't climb as hard or care about competing it's just like how you deal with failure right and you know, exactly. Just like you were saying, how you get back up and how you have the team and the support around you to help that and to facilitate that as an ideology instead of, oh, dude, you didn't get it, you know?
Right.
We'll be right back. Help us grow this podcast by giving us a 5-star rating on iTunes and posting a positive review. And of course, we would love it if you would share this episode with your friends and family. Thanks for listening. So you have Bend Racing, is that your team name?
Yeah, bed racing. Yeah.
And who's on the team?
Who is on the team? It is myself and my wife and Daniel. Daniel's the big guy that you see in TV and Eco Challenge. So we're the kind of core of the team. We're the ones that have also been climbing partners and expedition partners for years. And then we have a the woman that was racing in Eco Challenge with us was Mel Coombs. She's been a good friend of ours for a long time. Her and Chelsea actually swapped pregnancies so that we could keep racing as a team, which is awesome. So they staggered year and a half apart so they could have a baby, recover, race while the other one had a baby. So that was pretty awesome. And they're super close. And then we have, we had a guy named Steven, who's a climber that's lived in Bend. And then we have a couple international guys, a mountaineering guide from Norway, actually from Denmark, but lives in Norway, that we met on the racing circuit. And he was just this crazy Danish guy that saw us doing yoga. And like, he was kind of the only guy that we met early on that was into all these weird things that we were into. Like, he was a climber and he's like, oh, you guys do yoga. That's so great. All these other people were like these endurance athletes with the single mindset. So he's on our team now, and he's, you know, he's just super, you know, super great guy into acrobatics and all that stuff. So it takes a small group because we do like to do a lot of stuff, right? And we have to have people on our team that aren't just focused on like running and biking, because we're like, today we're gonna slackline, right? Or do, you know, do that kind of weird stuff. And then we have a couple from Montreal that we've raced with a lot. So our core team is those, you know, it's me and Chelsea and Dan. And then we have, you know, four or five that we kind of pull from for that four spot.
Does this group of athletes for Bend Racing, are you all professional athletes or do you hold down day jobs?
I've learned a lot from, you know, back in the day when all I wanted was a free pair of climbing shoes. It was going to be, I've learned that you can't eat gear. Like,
right, yeah.
So that's a tough thing, especially, and my kids certainly have no interest in eating gear. We are making it work. So we have a bunch of sponsorship, as racers, and to be honest, a good year is a year that we make enough in prize money and in sponsorship dollars that we break even, meaning that we don't pay for racing related expenses, like travel, race entries, that kind of stuff. My wife and I also teach acrobatics. Pre-COVID, that was our main thing. Like, for the last 10 years, we've kind of traveled around the world and taught like Cirque du Soleil style acrobatics. And done really, like, we have kind of a pretty solid international following and teach big workshops and events and stuff like that. So that's been our main, I guess, gig. And then Daniel is a software engineer for a bunch of startups. So he's pretty flexible. He works from home. And then, you know, so most of the people, I think the only one that has a real job or you know, in our close group is Mel. She's a helicopter pilot and a lawyer and a airline pilot and somehow has kids.
All kinds of stuff.
Like, it's crazy. She's the most busy, like, she just thrives on it, but like, it's crazy. Like, she goes to the start of one of these races and she's working 6-hour days on the computer while we're trying to get ready for the race in Fiji, right? And we're just like, all of us just want to sleep because we're finally without our kids, like me, you know?
Yeah.
But somehow she pulls it off. But yeah, I mean, for Chelsea and I, it's like we are, for lack of a better way to say it, like with the acrobatics and the racing, like that's how we make our living. I held a job as a rocket scientist for a couple of years and then quit that. Chelsea was a nurse for 2 days and quit that. And since then, it's been this combination of, you know, of the yoga slacklining stuff and we started a company called Yoga Slackers, which was basically a glorified way to justify being a dirtbag, right? Like, you know, especially the name Yoga Slackers, my parents were really upset. They're like, what? Like, yeah, we drive around in a car and we climb wherever we want and we set up slack lines and people pay us to teach them. And we're just like, how, you know, they don't pay us a lot, but whatever. It's enough to fill the car with gas and to buy some food. And so we did that for years, which was pretty awesome and built that into a minimal business. And at some point I built a climbing gym. I was always a little jealous of Aaron because his climbing gym was successful and tall.
Well, I mean, success is relative, but that's okay. That's a whole nother story.
I mean, you still have a gym, right?
Well, we're involved in the ownership part, but we don't run it anymore. So we do have other jobs and stuff that we do now. So
yeah,
we've moved to, that is a whole episode and there's a whole thing there. But
so what are your jobs?
I work for another company now that's like a contract company, but I actually do instructing. So I do fall protection training. So I teach people that climb towers now for work. So I guess it's professional climbing.
Yeah. Exactly.
I don't call myself a professional climber, but it's sort of that.
Yeah.
But it's sort of in the health and safety world. So okay. I do that. And it's a more reliable income than a climbing gym.
Yeah. Yeah,
one would imagine, especially during COVID.
Yeah,
yeah.
But
what do you do?
So I am a resume writer, which is not fancy. I used to be a journalist and a podcast producer, and then switched to PR. And then when we adopted Max, I started resume writing. I work for my dad's company.
Cool.
So the hours are super conducive to a child in school.
Yeah. That's awesome.
And then, obviously, you know, I hustle this podcast and painting.
So a lot of, it's for us, it's ironic because we've been, we get lucky a lot too. I like luck, and I have a belief that kind of luck is out there, and you just have to be a little bit of a risk taker. Like a life risk taker to recognize it and then step into it. Cause it doesn't always work out, but it's like, you know, to know when it's just like probably you guys leaving your climbing gym or like it gets scary having built these things up. You know, but we just recently, like when COVID hit, we basically, all our events had to cancel and we decided that it was a good time to step away from the acrobatics. Mm-hmm. Right. Because like teaching online just wasn't what we wanted to do. Right. And you know, and we've just got our biggest team sponsorship that we've ever had. Like we've been chasing like decent dollars for, you know, the last 15 years. And like all of a sudden, you know, we have more sponsorship, like enough at least to survive a year.
That's awesome. Just like,
we're just like, why are you guys doing this now? You know, like, but whatever. It's like, it's a kind of a crazy thing. And we're trying to build up our events. So our hope is that, you know, because we've been racing for a long time and we are willing to put on these big events, like the Expedition Oregon race has been the biggest one in the US like the last 2 years, and it sold out this year. So I actually get to pay myself. Like I get to
So that's money. The one that you guys run, you put it together, you operate it, or how does that work?
Yeah. We design the course and put it together and run it. And it's part of the Adventure Racing World Series. And we had to cancel last year, obviously because of COVID, it would have been the third edition. But this year it looks like we'll be able to have it at least in some, you know, thing. And it's got, you know, it's sold out and has a waiting list, which is awesome of teams coming from all over. And I mean, certainly the Eco Challenge show on Amazon helped. Like we had so many people after they saw that calling us and being like, we want to race. And we're just kind of like, yeah, but have you ever raced? And like some we let in, right? Cause that's how we started. Like we just jumped in. Like we didn't do a tiny race first. You know, it's like, we just got a bunch of our climber buddies together and we're like, let's go do this thing and survive. You know, so it's going to be cool. But our hope is that as we grow that, that will at least be, partial living. And, you know, as you guys know, if you're dirtbags, like I can live and Chelsea was a dirtbag too. So we can live on a lot less.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah. Raw potatoes and soy grits. Yeah. I've had a few.
Yeah. And we have this awesome store here called Grocery Outlet, which is basically like dumpster diving that you pay for. In the sense that they get like all the overstock and all the like the bruised stuff, but it's like sometimes, you know, 10 to 20 cents on the dollar and organic stuff. And like, you know, and so this is just our, like, we always go there first. Right. And, you know, it makes my parents feel a little bit better because they also do have a dumpster behind. Like we spent years. That's how it was fun. Dan and a lot of my teammates, like we spent a couple years just dumpster diving. Like, if you heard it, there's a semi-famous climber named Tom Grundy. Like if you've been in the world long enough, like he's been around and done a lot of stuff. He's the, like the new Fred Becky, except that he's a little bit better at relationships. but you know, Tom taught us how to dumpster dive. And for years, like when I met Chelsea, I was living in a tiny squalor in Tucson, climbing a ton, teaching yoga and dumpster diving. I had like a $10 a month food budget. And Chelsea and I would have dates and like, she knew about this and we'd go to the dumpster and like, we'd just decide to make dinner from whatever the dumpster provided. Right. Sometimes there were flowers and, you know, and
it takes a special lady.
Yeah,
at one time, one time when we were living in Flagstaff, we found, we were really like, we literally, it was after like there was the peanut butter scare or the peanut scare, and like they discontinued or got rid of all these Clif Bars, and like we filled a minivan with peanut butter Clif Bars, right? And then a week later, like got 55 gallons of Haagen-Dazs ice cream from a dumpster, and luckily it was winter, so we just buried them in our yard in Flagstaff. We had 55 gallons of ice cream in our yard at Flagstaff. So every morning coffee was full of ice cream. Like we just make our coffee and just like put a big scoop of ice cream into it. I mean, when we left our lease, there must've still been like 20 gallons of ice cream.
Oh God.
Buried throughout.
Oh, so, my, buried.
Yeah. You know, so the making a living is, you know, it's a little harder with kids, right? Cause then there's that constant, like, do we want to get, give our kids nice stuff? And
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it is, it's going to be an interesting, you know, time in the next couple of years to see, you know, to see how everything goes.
Yeah. I definitely want to like look forward in 5 years and see, what you guys are doing. With
I
that.
Mean, it's good to see that there's definitely been a lot of change with you, but there are those things that haven't changed very much, Jason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there's like, I like to think that I'm definitely slower. Right. I like to think I'm a little bit smarter. You know, it's weird because my brother's living in New Zealand now. And so we're still really close. And we actually bought a tiny house over there right next to him. And so until COVID hit, we were going there, you know, 3 or 4 months a year and just hanging out. I mean, they live in a tiny house. We bought an even tinier house off of Facebook for like 20 grand. It was crazy. This, you know,
it's great.
Tiny lot in New Zealand. He just sent us a message one day saying, hey, there's somebody selling a house for 20,000 US. And so now we have a place that we can, it's a little bigger than a car, but we go there with the kids. And I mean, you know, really, it's just we're still okay with our life being pretty simple.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, you remember the cars that we were driving back, you know, it's still,
absolutely.
We just have the next version of that. We have a 2003 Subaru with a cracked windshield and a 1996 Toyota truck that's like, you know, and they putter around. Chelsea really wants a Tesla.
Really? Oh, that's definitely a step up.
Yeah, you moved to the Tesla universe. A whole new world for her.
I mean, that's, but that's three houses in New Zealand. I don't understand.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But, you know,
So you need to send us, and hopefully you could put it on the website, a picture of the Yoga Slackers car that you and Chelsea traveled around in.
Yeah. And that's still out there. Cause then Sam and Raquel traveled around in it. And then now they're building a bigger one, but it still runs. Like it's
building
just
a bigger one. Cause that was Mad Max material.
Oh, it totally was Mad Max material. Right. And then Sam just kept even working on it until, like, he had to reinforce the structure because it had like two top boxes and mountain bikes and solar. It was just like, you know, and it just had to be, because it got to where its Festiva body that got 40 miles to a gallon, it just wasn't the case anymore. Like you literally had to change the whole, the struts and the brakes and, you know, everything once every 3 months. Like it just couldn't, you know, it gained too much weight. But I think Ford just did a big piece on that.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah, it's pretty.
You know what's interesting is like you see all these vans now, the van life thing and these super nice, fancy $50,000 to $80,000 vans.
More than that.
Okay, maybe more.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you think about how we used to travel for climbing trips and live out of our car. I mean, my wife and I, we lived out of our car for like 4 months and it was a little Subaru 99 Forester and we didn't think twice about it. And now people would not do that.
No.
They would drop 80 grand on a van and, you know, have a stove inside and everything. And
van life is not like the dirtbag life. And by the way, I might actually have your Subaru. What happened to it? I have a 99 Subaru Forester. That's the one that has the.
Oh, I've had two. One of them had 300,000 miles on it. It's probably not that one.
Right.
Okay. I sold it for like $500 to some guy from Southeast Oklahoma. He did drive away in it too.
I was surprised.
And then I bought another, because I love that one so much. I bought another 99 Subaru Forester and drove it till it had like 200 something thousand miles. And that one I traded in. I have a newer Forester now. Okay. I've had three Foresters. I have a problem, I think.
Well, no, we're like our neighbors, the next door neighbors with the kids, and they have a like a 2016 Forester. And again, like there's certain things that, that my wife and I don't agree on. Like I want to drive a dirtbag late model car for the rest of my life that mm-hmm. I buy for under $2,000 and then mm-hmm. keep it going until it dies. Like she really wants the 2016 Forester with the backup cameras and like the comfort, but you know.
Man, they're pretty nice. I'm just saying.
Yeah. Is that what you have, a newer one?
No, I mean, I have an even newer Forester and it's the first new car I've ever had. And
I've had it two or three years. Can't talk to my wife. Sorry.
I know I can't. I'm sorry, but I'm telling you, it's, you know, and I could see driving this car till it's 300,000 miles. Yeah, That's how much I like it.
I will admit that like I had a 96 minivan that I bought for $500 and then the Subaru Forester, and then they both broke down in like 2 days, the same 2 days. And like, yeah, that was a pain. And then I have to figure out how to transport the kids around. And then my borrowed my parents' car and then that broke down. So I just had some curse with like every car I got in, it just broke down. So yeah, one of these days, I think, you know, Chelsea's big plan right now is that she's trying to get a company to give us a car.
Yeah,
that's smart. I don't know if
that's going to happen.
That'd be great.
That seems like a long shot, but
maybe not Tesla, but I mean, sure. Why not?
I don't think it seems like a long shot, honestly.
No, I don't think it is. I mean, going back to the world's toughest race thing, you guys got quite a bit of airtime by comparison to the number of teams that were on there. You guys finished first as the American team in that race,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that was a surprise. I mean, that was one of our goals. In that they didn't show them, but in the very pre-race interviews, we said, they asked us like what our goals were. And we said, well, yeah, obviously we want to win. And if we don't win, we want to be the top American team, right? And they're like, what's the only thing that's going to stop that from happening? And we're like, well, Dan falling apart. Like if anybody else on the team falls apart, Dan throws us over his shoulder and carries us through the jungle. If Dan falls apart, it takes all three of us to move him anywhere. Right. And he's only fallen like in 50 races we've done together. He's fallen apart twice, usually with heat stroke. So we knew this going in and he just didn't really communicate during the thing. Cause we were having so much fun being in first place, you know, beating the Kiwis that we know are really, like the world's best paddlers. And we just did a ton of training. And so, it was cool to come, you know, to make that big comeback. And so that'd be, you know, like to literally going from, I don't think we're going to make the cutoff because Dan can't move, to actually being able to race again. So yeah, we got great airtime, you know, which is the so ironic thing good. Is we're trying to get less people to move to Bend because we love Bend and it's, you know, we don't want it to turn it into Boulder or like get too overcrowded. And then now, people across the world know that Bend, Oregon is a cool place to live, unfortunately. But
I definitely want to ask, what was it like working with Bear Grylls? Did you guys actually interact with him, or was all of his stuff shot pretty separate of the race?
Yeah, it was great. Like he was out there. Like he was out there in the race. And certainly as I'm sure you guys probably feel a little bit the same way, like we went in with a certain feeling about Bear Grylls, right? Because he's on TV a lot and you're just kind of like roll your eyes. Like every time I see him pull out a rope and like say, oh, we're gonna need to do this, we're like, no, that's the wrong choice. Like what are you doing? Like don't rappel off that random thing, or you know, or
yeah,
you know, in his shows. And Chelsea actually worked on a show with him as a raft guide. Like she was a longtime kayaker, so she knew firsthand like how these things were filmed, where they like showed him building this raft for like 2 minutes and then the rest of his staff built the raft and he flew back to the hotel. Right. And then came back out.
You just ruined everything for me.
Sorry. And then like, you know, used his raft to go down this, you know, whitewater river, which was like a short section of a known river where they had kayak safety everywhere, you know, but they're like shooting him, like going down this wild river to get out of some canyon. And it's like, okay, it's like, again, it's like reality TV. Right. And so we had these things, but like the great thing was with this race and a lot of the top teams, you know, they had the 40 top teams in the world there racing. And most of us were really, if they wouldn't have given us $50,000, we wouldn't have gone. Right. Because we're like, this is going to be a show. Like we actually want to go race. But as soon as the race started, it was a race, you know, like it's funny, you're standing at the start line and when he does the big unveil and he's talking about all this, they made us do like three takes. Right. They only show one. They're like, okay, he's going to say this and he's going to say, go to the boats, but don't really go to the boats. Stand there. And then we're going to do it again from a different angle, different angle. And they're doing all the shots of him flying in on the helicopter. But once the race started, it was fully a race. Right. And he was out there, you know, I'm sure getting dropped off by a helicopter, but like in the rain, in the mud, like talking to us. And he came over when we finally, Dan fell apart. we, you know, finally got him into the boat. And when we finished that stage, when we got to the first camp, like Dan really wasn't sure he could keep going, right? Like he was really beaten down. He'd been in the doghouse for a long, long time. We were going so slow. And, you know, Bear came over, right? And was like, dude, you guys are so impressive. Like, you're, you know, I can't believe you're still going. Like, we were sure you were out. Like, this is the kind of tenacity that, you know, that makes me so proud to be a part of this race. And like, just this conversation with Dan, right? And we're just like, that was pretty sweet. And then Dan, like, it just, you know, like Dan would have kept going anyway, but he would have been a little bit like, you know, like dragging, you know, dragging somebody through because he knows that that's happened. But he was just like, I got it. I want to do this. And so it was, you know, and he did that for a lot of teams, like especially some of these less experienced teams that would have dropped out, that were on the verge of dropping out. He would go there and say, basically like what I talked about earlier, like, why? Like, you guys are here. Like, this is what you came for. Like, keep going. And it turned a lot of teams around, which is pretty cool.
I remember the team that one of them fell and they were suspecting concussion. And I felt like on TV they really overhyped. I was like, this person is fine to keep riding. And I felt like they really dramatized it quite a bit.
The secrets are not, you know, I'm not too worried because we're pretty vocal in the community. Like, that was like, these are some of the teams afterwards that came to us or that we're hoping to help train, right?
Okay. Because
that, you know, I cannot, like, I don't understand that thing. We're just like, I'm watching that. Like, I didn't know any of these stories until I watch it, right? Even though we were there. I'm like, why are they dropping out? Like, and they made the choice to ride backwards to get medical help instead of to go forwards. And I'm like, they're done. As soon as they go backwards, they're not going to redo those 20 miles.
Yeah.
Right. Like, why not go forward? And if you start to, they have a doctor on the team. If he starts to exhibit like dangerous signs, right? Like, sit down and pull out your spot button and get him out of there. It's like, you know, they were struggling as it is, but it kind of became, for lack of a better way to say, an excuse, right? To drop out, which is,
that's what it looked like.
Yeah, it totally. And, you know, there are, so on the other side, like Team New Zealand, the best in the world, like there was a world championship, I think in 2017. Where they're racing, like, you know, a day from the finish line. And this is, I think, in Australia, like a kangaroo comes running out as they're riding along this dirt road and like slams into the side of the bike at speed of the woman, right? And she crashes horribly, splits her helmet open, certainly has as much of a concussion as you know, you can get on a mountain bike, like is totally dazed. Like her bike is all messed up. And they sit there and they put it back together. They let her rest for a little bit. They really watch her and they go to the finish line and win the world championships. And you're just like, you know, and
that's how you do it.
That's how you do it.
Right. And then the other team that was really hard for me, like the two girls that you talked about, the two girls and the dad, I'm just like, dude, why didn't you just sleep a little more, like at least hike to the next camp. But that was the team that dropped out on the last day. Right. The team that had the bike wreck. Right.
Yes. Right. And
the guy is like bleeding a little bit, but he's fine. He's walking around. They've camped there. Like the medical team is there. And he just like takes one of his buddies over and says, hey, man, is it okay if we drop out? And I'm just like, I know that spot. They were literally like 15 hours from the finish line and they'd been racing for 9 days. They still had 48 hours. They could have slept for a whole day and still finished the race. Right. And that was just this example. Like they didn't even talk about it as a team. Right. So they kind of made it seem nice on TV, but like half the team didn't even know that that guy was dropping out. Right. No. There was no conversation. There was no, hey, is this okay? Like these teams, you know, they're kind of like, it's tough because a lot of these teams don't ever race together again when they fail because they don't have the relationships built to deal with that or to understand that, you know, it's like we spent 6 months of our life training all this time away from our families. And then this one guy that got in a mountain bike that is still fine. Like, and you know, we saw him at the end and he's walking around, like he's got like some road rash on his face, but it was just a, you know, interesting choice to see some of these teams, you know, drop out like in those moments. Right. And, you know, so that's, those are kind of the backstories. And these people are all great. Like we've become kind of friends with a lot of them, but yeah, I'm just like, dude, that's, I'm glad that that's not part of our, you know, our path, right? Even when Dan was down there, it was like everybody was sure Dan was going to drop out. Like they had a medical team ready to evacuate him, right? And then we asked, you know, the medical team said, "We're like, you guys have to say." And we're like, "No, we're just going to lay here in the mud for 4 hours and see what happens. So,
I had one thing on the race that I was wondering about, and this is something that I feel like came up again and again, was just the sleep element. It just seems like over 11 days that part, just the level of sleep exhaustion sort of that you would get, and the mental game that would play not having sleep, that seemed to be one of the biggest challenges to me.
Yeah. And I think that is where, sleep deprivation is a part of the race, right? That is one of the things that makes it unique versus kind of anything else that's out there, is that you have to deal with that sleep deprivation. And teams that don't have the capacity to, or the understanding. And the cool thing that I like in retrospect is sleep deprivation. It brings out the crazy side of people, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like the dark kind of demon. Yeah. All that stuff comes out. And, it's taken me years, but like, I remember being in a race with my wife and finally sleeping. We're going to sleep for 20 minutes. It was a big race in New Zealand and we're exhausted. We've, had a lot of stuff go wrong and right. And we're really close to being like the first US team to ever break inside the top 10 in this race. And we go to sleep and she wakes up. She wakes me up. Like I've just fallen asleep. We're going to sleep for 20 minutes. Not a long time. She wakes me up and she's like, "I'm a bad mother." What are you talking about? She's like, "I'm a really bad mother. You and Max would be better off without me. I'm just going to wander off into the wilderness and you'll never see me again." What are you talking about? She's like, "I've been thinking about this for a long time. I'm just a bad mother." And blah. And I'm just like, "Oh my God, like what is going on?" And, and she's like, basically telling me she's going to like commit suicide by exposure. Like just, go to sleep. You need your sleep. When you wake up, I just won't be here. And I'm just like, of course I can't sleep. Right.
So right.
I'm like, "Oh my God, what's going on?" And then 20 minutes later, like she's passed back out and she wakes up and she's like, "Come on, let's go. We're done. Do you remember any of that?" And she's like, I don't know, whatever, And so like, this was a pattern. I realized like her dark place is like that self-doubt comes out and she's usually not like that at all. Right. But like, I had to learn that I don't have to take that seriously. Right. And so it's, I don't know, like you see that and you saw that in Fiji, like teams that were really held together. And that's probably part of that concussion thing that happened, like when people get so tired.
Oh, right.
Like, yeah. Just looking, a lot of the time you're just looking for a way that you can just sleep. Right. Like, you just want the sleep deprivation to end instead of embracing it. And, you get to hallucinate though. It's pretty cool. You definitely hallucinate a lot while you're out there. So
I guess in closing, what's next for Bend Racing and or you and your wife?
We actually, Chelsea's actually going to race the Expedition Oregon race, which is, she got picked up by a team. So she's not, she doesn't organize it. So, and she doesn't navigate. So that'll be fun for her. Cause she's, after having the kid and, their second kid and stuff, she's really eager to get back. We'll have a pretty full race schedule as much as it can happen. We'll go to world championships and a bunch of other events, Expedition Canada, as a team. And then, we're really just trying to, I was hoping to get a chance to say this. My big thing as a race director has been making the races that I always wished existed when I was 20 years old and climbing with you guys. And so we're now starting to put on races that have actual technical rock climbing in them. We're like first organization.
That's cool to see.
In the world. The last Expedition Oregon had a 3-pitch route that teams had to lead that went to the top of a spire that was 5'8", right? And super exposed to, it's awesome, and we had staff out there, but they had to lead it. Right. They had to carry their own ropes and lead it and then wrap off the backside. And we just had a technical 6-hour race that had an orienteering course where there was like rope climbing, right? Top ropes and leads and kind of like maybe the old horseshoe hell, like those got points. And so we're about to put one on that climbs to the top of a 170-foot crumbling desert like sandstone on the backside of Smith Rock. Like total adventure 5'5", right? And so not everybody has to do it. They're always optional, but I'm really starting to get back into this technical whitewater, this more expedition feel where there is a lot of, and then we're trying to make it as safe as possible, but also be very upfront with people that that, you know, these are the races that we grew up wishing that there were, you know, mm-hmm. forever. Patagonia was the only one. So we're, I don't know how liability works and, you know, all that stuff. So I'm pretty naive in that, but we're just trying to create that community of people that want to come, you know, test themselves in that way and keep it as safe as possible. So that's our big goal, is like to race really hard, to have a lot of fun with our kids, to deal with the mental letting go of like the acrobatics, which has been kind of our bread and butter. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and for me to get another hip and get so I like walking again.
I think this sounds like something Aaron and I should sign up for, and we'll start a team.
I mean, honestly, like everybody that I've ever known that got into it from some sort of a more expedition background, whether it's climbing or mountaineering or, you know, or big bike packing trips where you're choosing to do it, mm-hmm. like, and you basically are choosing these things that are basically like adventure races without even knowing it, right? It's amazing. Like, it's just, you know, the cool thing is there's that little bit of a time limit. So you push yourself a little bit harder than you might in an expedition, and you feel a little bit better about that feeling tired, right? You know, which, I mean, honestly, I think that climbers make some of the best racers out there, right? So, and it's a lot of fun, yeah. because you already have that, yeah. that teamwork and that trust built in.
And if people want to find more about you guys as a team and or your race series, where can they go?
Yeah, just bendracing.com.
Nice. Amazing. Thank you.
Thank you.
Aaron, you have an update since we recorded this episode.
Yes, Jason recently underwent surgery for the resurfacing of his other hip, and he's been recovering really well. He posted a video recently of him using a walker, racing his 18-month-old son, and even though he gave it a good try, his son ended up winning. Also, the film that his wife Chelsea is featured in, named With Spirit, it's currently making the festival circuit, but we got a sneak peek of it, and I think you and I can agree that it was excellent.
Yes, I really enjoyed it, and I'm crossing my fingers that we get to speak with Chelsea someday soon. And we are definitely wishing Jason and his family well and a speedy recovery. That's a wrap for us this week. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear and want to support the show, find us at scissortailsessions.com.